This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Demon Home, Champions of the Dawning Dragons, Book 3. Written by Michael G. Manning. Performed by Derek Perkins. Chapter 1. Matthew watched Moira and the others leave with a feeling of relief. His sister frequently irritated him. He wasn't entirely sure why, but if asked, he knew he could come up with a list of reasons on short notice. None of the particular reasons he might list would be the full truth, however. The reality was that it was just her presence that annoyed him. Too many questions, too much talking, he thought to himself. She was constantly trying to figure him out. Even when she kept her thoughts and questions to herself, he could almost feel her watching him, curious. The same was true of his parents, but they weren't as close, as present, as always there, as Moira was. In general, he felt the same about most people, although to a far milder degree. His friends didn't press or pry as much, so they were tolerable. Strangers were even better. They wouldn't bother you at all, unless you gave them a reason. For the most part, he preferred the company of his own thoughts. Those were interesting, and other people rarely had anything to contribute. In fact, they usually just interfered by trying to inject their own interests and opinions into his mind. Graham was an exception to the rule. He listened, without pretending to understand, whenever Matthew felt a need to air out his ideas. Repeating that thought to himself, Matthew realized it might be construed as an insult, but to him it wasn't. It's a really rare trait, and valuable, as far as I'm concerned. If only people were more like books. Books didn't force you to read them. They waited, with their knowledge clearly displayed and summarized in a title and short description. If you were interested, they revealed themselves at whatever pace you desired, never forcing themselves into your attention. Moira and the others had passed beyond the limit of his mage sight now. He was alone, except for his dragon, Desiccus. "What now?" asked the dragon, his voice resonating inside the young wizard's mind. "Now we see what we can discover about where our strange visitors came from," said Matthew aloud.
"The cave is too small for me to enter."
"Wait out here. I don't need you at the moment," said Matthew, as he returned to the cave entrance. Slipping inside, he worked his way back to the chamber they had discovered. There it was. He felt it immediately, a strange sense of blurring, as though the world was ever so slightly out of focus. It wasn't a new sensation, but he had discovered over the past couple of years that it seemed to be something unique to him. Neither his father nor his sister had ever mentioned it, and during a number of conversations, he had slowly come to realize that what he experienced wasn't a regular aspect of mage sight, at least not for other mages. His private exploration regarding the sensation was what had led him to experimenting with what he called translational magic. Magic that manipulated not the world or the environment, but the very fabric that existence was built upon. His father had created enchanted bags that allowed him to store items in faraway locations, using a variation of teleportation magic. But Matthew had improved upon the concept by creating bags that stored items in other dimensions. Even Graham's enchanted sword, Thorn, was stored that way. The tattoo his friend used to summon the blade and his armor simply connected him to another dimension. But Matthew had long suspected that he was just scratching the surface of what translation magic was capable of doing. There were times when he caught glimpses of things that hadn't happened yet, usually events that were close in the near future, but also in the recent past. The visions weren't limited to sight either, and on one or two awkward occasions, he had caught himself answering questions that hadn't been asked yet. A casual consideration of his experiences might conclude that he was somehow accessing the future or seeing through time, something that would be properly called precognition. But he had decided that that interpretation was fundamentally flawed. He had learned to keep a firm grip on his perceptions, but when he relaxed his focus, he often saw multiple versions of the near future, as well as multiple past. It was like living in a world that had thousands of different copies of itself laid on top of one another. Taken together, those copies created a blur. Some copies were in sync with the present, but others were slightly ahead or behind, and none were truly identical. He wasn't seeing the future or the past. He was seeing the vast infinity of alternative realities that lay close to his own. That was the truth of the Elenial gift. It was the mechanism that had once allowed Elenial Crytek to avoid almost any attack, dodging blows before they were even begun, and it was the source of the visions that his mother's prophetic dreams had once shown her. Exploring his gift had taught him that it was more than just an ability to perceive other realities, however. He could touch them. Using enchantments, he could connect them permanently, as he had done with the pouch that now hung from his belt. Fashioned properly, they could even be weapons, like the extraplanar triangle he had used to destroy Chell Strathek. And now, something had crossed over. The strangely flavored aether that his sister had sensed, the blur that he still experienced here, was a result of that crossing. Their world had briefly been connected to another dimension at this point, one that was much farther apart from it than the usual closely related ones that Matthew always felt hovering close at hand. That connection had created a local disturbance, a strange resonance. He could study that, if he opened his senses to it. Matthew thought he might even be able to follow it. So he did. It began with a rush of vertigo as he allowed his perception to be swept away from the close layers, from the reality he was anchored in, the reality he lived within. It was like jumping into a fast-moving river, or perhaps the ocean when the tides were moving out. Reality boiled around him, shifting and roiling so rapidly that understanding was no longer possible. He was guided by nothing more than a feeling or some ephemeral instinct. His perception passed through countless planes, and he could feel others even farther out, some so strange and alien that he knew that peering too closely at them might destroy his sanity, or perhaps even his body, if he were to touch them. That feeling led him to the origin of the crossing, but it wasn't a single point. Like his own world, the one he found was a vast collection of closely related dimensions, many of them with disturbances that indicated a crossing. The crossing had happened from a multitude of closely related dimensions, and touched an equal number of those planes that were near to his own. It was like any other event, he supposed, repeated over and over through a great number of similar realities. As a result, finding the exact one that had touched his own was probably impossible, if not pointless. Far more important would be finding one that was compatible with his own nature. But how to choose? Relax. It was another mind, or was it his own? The thought was communicated to him almost as a feeling. If it held words, they had probably been supplied by his own brain. And then he saw it, or felt it. He couldn't say which. It was everything, the space between planes and dimensions. It was what lay between, the source of consciousness that underlay all reality, or perhaps it was reality, and the dimensions that surrounded it were merely its dreams and fictions. Both interpretations were valid. We are Elenial. Another truth, and one that Tyrion had never been able to see in the knowledge given to him by the Loshti. The name, Elenial, was merely the term his brain supplied. But the vast consciousness truly had no name. It was every mind, every perception, every point of view, gathered together here, in the timeless space that lay between. Elenial might be better used as a more specific term, a name for those creatures like himself, who were capable of transcending their locality to reach the heart of infinity. In that sense, the original Elenials were not Shi'har, but some of the Shi'har had been Elenials, the ones he had inherited his gift from. Width and breadth of the experience was beyond what his mind could comprehend, beyond what any mind could comprehend. But it carried no shock or discomfort with it. He had merely shifted points of view. In that instant, he was simply more than he had been. And within that other self, the knowledge of infinity was not a strain. It simply was. The planes of existence that rode upon his surface were infinitely varied, but some were dark, black, and invisible to his limitless vision. The collection that he had been examining before was among those. They were different, somehow. They were apart. Even though they floated upon the same overarching consciousness, they were devoid of its mind, like dead stones sinking through a living sea. As he considered travelling to one of them again, he felt fear.
But you must. You were born of them, of the darkness, and you must return.
Couldn't they just ignore them? Why not leave them alone?
They will not be ignored.
Matthew felt the truth of it. His own world had once been one of them, long ago, before Tyrion's time, until the Shi'ha had visited it, until they had transformed it. As he watched, he could see the effect of the crossing around him. Some plains went dark, changing from glowing jewels in the sea of existence to dark stones. But at the same time, some of the dark worlds grew bright and began to glow with the light of consciousness. It was an endless battle that played out over and over, and he no longer had the option of ignoring it. His world was connected now. Either his world would return to the darkness, or the other would be brought into the light. Those were the only choices, and he would be the arbiter who decided, either through his action or his refusal to act.
Very well, Matthew responded,
and with that thought, he withdrew. A maelstrom swirled around him and finally resolved itself, leaving him standing once more in a cave in the Elentir Mountains. Desiccus stood waiting faithfully outside when he emerged.
Did you learn anything?
The dragon's question startled him. What he had experienced was impossible to articulate. He had gained some knowledge, but most of it was gone. What was left was like a short summary. The human mind couldn't possibly contain all of what he had seen. Perhaps it was something like what his father underwent whenever he used his abilities as an archmage. Mordecai had tried to explain it to him on several occasions, but the main lesson he had managed to convey was that he couldn't express it, because as a man, he couldn't fully remember what he'd experienced when he merged with the larger world around him. So an archmage merges the self with the greater consciousness of the world around him. But what did I do? I went somewhere else. He needed to talk to his father. If anyone could shed light on the strangeness of it all, it would be his dad. But that wasn't possible. Not until they found him.
We have to travel there, he told the dragon.
You can do that? Asked Desiccus.
Matthew nodded.
I can. If we're to find the answers we need to examine the other side of this puzzle. The side that our visitors came from.
The dragon's mental answer held a note of disapproval.
That does not sound wise. There are too many unknowns. You should discuss this with your mother and sister, as well as the other wizards.
They won't understand, said Matthew. Dad might, but he's what this is all about, isn't he? He might be over there now, and if he is, this is the only way we'll find him.
Then you should bring some of them with you. Alone, the risk is too great.
Matthew stared at the dragon.
That's what you're for. I can go and return with ease, but the others can't. If we were separated, or if something happened to me, they could be trapped. I can't risk bringing anyone else until I understand what we're facing.
Desiccus snorted, and his next thought came across with a heavy sense of sarcasm.
Glad to know you worry about me as well.
You wouldn't let me leave you behind anyway. Besides, what could pose a threat to you?
The dragon used one claw to score a deep groove into a large piece of granite, before examining the undamaged talon.
There is truth in that, he replied.
How will we do this?
Matthew approached him and reached out with one hand, before laying it against the dragon's massive forelimb.
Brace yourself. This will probably be very disorienting. Just keep still until the world starts to make sense again.
What does that mean?
Desiccus's thought cut off abruptly as everything shivered and began to blur around him. Chapter 2 It was easier this time, despite bringing the dragon along. Matthew already knew where they were going, and the actual effort of translating them from their original location to a new dimension seemed to involve only a small amount of Aethar. He felt a faint resistance as they entered the dark dimension that was his target. It felt like falling into an icy lake. The shock drove the air from his lungs. As the world resolved itself, Matthew found himself in absolute darkness. Not merely the metaphorical darkness he had seen from the place in between, but truly black, devoid of all sight or sense. He could feel nothing. It was as though his mage sight had utterly vanished, along with his eyesight. The air seemed to press in against him, making him feel claustrophobic as he drew deep breaths to compensate for the horrifying feeling that he must be suffocating. Matthew wasn't prone to panic, however. After the first disorienting shock passed, he realized that his mage sight wasn't truly gone. He could still sense his body, and Desiccus was there, beside him. Beyond that, though, there was nothing. Just a black emptiness. Bending down, he felt the ground beneath his feet. It was rough stone. The cool air smelled of damp earth. Despite his dragon-enhanced eyesight, he could detect no hint of light. "We are back in the cave," he realized. "That's why there's no light. No light and no aether." That was why the world he had chosen seemed dark when viewed from the place in between, because it lacked aether. It was dead and empty as far as his arcane senses were concerned. His thoughts were interrupted as the dragon by his side began to issue a deep, rumbling growl. Desiccus was disturbed by their unusual surroundings. Brilliant yellow light blossomed in the cave as flames began to shoot forth from between bared teeth. "It's all right," said Matthew. "We're just underground."
"I cannot see," came the dragon's seldom-used voice. "I can't hear your thoughts."
"There's no ambient aether here," Matthew soothed. "But you can still see. Your flames lit the darkness for a moment."
"How did we get underground?" asked Desiccus. "We were outside."
"I was aiming for the cave," said Matthew. "I'm still new to this, but I don't think it would have mattered where we were in our world. The spot I was aiming for in this one was this cave." Another flare from the dragon's mouth illuminated the rock walls for a moment.
"And how do you propose we exit this place? I see no openings around us."
Matthew wasn't so sure of that. If this dimension was a close analog for their own, then the cave should be very similar to the one in their world. He needed more light to be sure, though. Concentrating, he focused his aether to create a light globe above his outstretched hand. "Liet." It was something he had done 1,000 times before, but it was much harder now. All of the aether had to come from within. Slowly the light built as he put forth his strength, and after several seconds he had a brilliant ball hovering over their heads. There was no exit.
"Well, this is inconvenient," muttered the young wizard.
"I could dig us free, given enough time," suggested Desiccus. "My flame would be faster still. It can melt stone."
"I'd be dead from the heat or lack of air before you got through all that rock," said Matthew. Briefly, he wondered which would kill him first, or which would be the most unpleasant. "Burning, definitely," he decided, before turning his thoughts to more practical solutions.
"It will be safer, for me at least, if I do it."
"I'll never understand how your race survived so long," commented the dragon. "Almost anything can kill your kind."
Matthew smirked. "You were built to be resilient."
"You only underscore my point," said Desiccus. "Your father created us. If he could do that, why not create stronger bodies for himself and his offspring?"
"Gareth Galen tried that once," rebutted Matthew. "Eventually he decided it was better to be human."
"For what reason?" snorted the dragon.
"Apparently he ate most of his friends, and that put him off the whole thing," explained Matthew. Desiccus laughed, a disturbingly deep barking sound coming from his throat.
"I can hardly blame him for that. Your people smell delicious."
The wizard gave his companion an odd look. "Compared to what?"
"Sheep," returned the dragon immediately. "Or even worse, goats. They smell terrible, although honestly I'd take a cow, or better still a horse, over a human any day. I'll never understand why your family insists on feeding me goats. There are so many better options."
"Goats are cheaper," the young mage informed him. Even my father would go broke if he fed you on cows every day. He tried not to think of the dragon eating horses. For some reason that image disturbed him more than the thought of Desiccus eating people. How often do you think about eating people?
Only when I'm dreaming.
Moira must have been seriously disturbed when she made his personality, thought Matthew. Do you really have dreams like that? Desiccus laughed again.
No. Usually it's deer or horses.
That's a relief.
Though sometimes I imagine them with a nice human sauce drizzled over the top, continued the dragon.
Now he knew Desiccus was pulling his leg. His companion had a bizarre sense of humour. How would you even make human sauce? Dragons don't cook.
I'll admit I don't understand human cooking, pun intended. But I would imagine you just mash them up. What could be simpler?
Matthew couldn't help chuckling, but after a moment he added, Just remember this. You are not to eat any people ever. The dragon sighed.
Not even the bad ones?
Was that sarcasm? Desiccus's voice was too foreign to the normal range of human inflection to be certain, and without being able to hear his thoughts directly, it made his true meaning ambiguous for Matthew to know. Not even the bad ones, unless I give you permission first.
What about dead ones?
Huh?
What if they're already dead? Say perhaps if we found some that had fallen off a cliff and they were already dead. It would be wrong to let them go to waste.
Matthew gave Desiccus a flat stare. No! The dragon chuffed.
Fine.
Are we done with this topic now? I need to focus on getting us out of here.
Since you refuse to be objective about that matter, then I suppose we are, answered Desiccus.
But after a brief pause, he spoke up again.
Wait, what if they want me to eat them?
The young wizard gaped at him. In what scenario would that ever happen?
I've heard that sometimes your kind kill themselves.
You mean suicide? It's against the law. You shouldn't do it, even if someone asked. Why would you think that was all right? The dragon coughed.
I like helping people.
Matthew fought to suppress another laugh. Of all the dragons I could have chosen, I had to pick a comedian. Then another thought occurred to him. When was the last time you ate?
Yesterday.
A single day wasn't long for a dragon. They tended to eat large meals and could go several days or even a week without eating again, although it depended greatly on how much they exerted themselves. He's definitely not hungry, then. Let me concentrate, said Matthew. This isn't going to be easy. Opening the pouch on his belt, he reached in to withdraw an item he thought would help, but his fingers came up short, discovering the bottom of the pouch just inches in. While that would have been normal with most such containers, it wasn't with this one. The pouch was enchanted to open into an extra-dimensional space that he used to store various items. Of course it wouldn't work here, he realized. I'm no longer on the same plane. That demi-plane isn't close to this one. It was a sobering thought. He had stored a lot of useful items there, and being unable to reach them seriously limited his options. He made a quick mental tally of what he had left. My clothes, a sword, dagger, eating knife, and not much else. Oh well, nothing said he had to stay long. If a need arose, he could always just return and fetch whatever he needed. Staring at the heavy granite that blocked their exit from the mountain, he felt uncharacteristically nervous. Using magic while being unable to properly use his mage sight was an unfamiliar sensation, akin to sword fighting while wearing a blindfold. He couldn't sense anything beyond the cave itself, which now had a small amount of aethar filling it, a product of his presence and the magical light he had created. Not knowing how much stone blocked the way, or what might lie beyond it, was discomforting. It would also be much more difficult, since the stone had no aethar of its own. It was utterly dead, which meant all the power had to come from him. Even so, he didn't feel it would be worth drawing upon Desiccus. I just need to use an efficient spell procedure to minimize wasted aethar. He toyed with the idea of carefully removing the stone in blocks to gradually create a tunnel. But while each step would be simple, it would ultimately cost him more energy and a lot more time. Sometimes the best solution just happened to be the more dramatic and explosive one. He began by drawing a circle around himself to reinforce the shield he would need to protect himself from falling stone if the cavern collapsed. Then he mentally drew a series of cross-hatched lines on the stone face in front of him. Rehearsing the words in his mind first, he then began a short chant in Lycian, carefully describing what he intended to do with his power.
Nilo en strath. Lines reinforced by my strength, focusing outward, fracturing stone and pressing outward. Break the earth and seek the sky.
The last bit was a bit poetic, but poetry often worked better than dry exposition, although both had their place. As he spoke, he visualized what he wanted and put forth his magic, driving it into the dead stone with his will. His mage sight expanded with his power, following it into the rock, like a vision seen on a dark night during a flash of lightning. It took far more of his strength than it should have, and still nothing happened for several long seconds. Sweat began to build on his brow as the tension in the granite grew ever greater, until the rocks around him seemed to vibrate. And then it exploded. Parts of the cavern ceiling broke away to be harmlessly deflected by his shield, while the entire wall of stone in front of him vanished, shattering and flying outward. Sunlight, impossibly bright after being in the cave, flooded in, making the stone dust in the air difficult to see through. Matthew had anticipated the dust and made sure his shield would keep it out. Summoning a stiff breeze, he dispersed it quickly, but the effort made him pant. He felt as though he had run a marathon. What he had done required a lot of power, but back home he wouldn't have expected to tire so quickly. "Stay here," he told the dragon. "But I want to look around first. There might be people out there. I doubt they'd react well if they saw you," he explained. "I'll be back in a little while."
Desiccus growled. "What am I supposed to do while you scout around?"
"Take a nap," suggested the young wizard.
"I don't want it.
That's an order," added Matthew, putting a tone of authority in his voice.
Desiccus promptly laid his head between his forelimbs and closed his eyes.
"Well, I didn't mean that kind of order, but I suppose that's fine," thought Matthew.
Walking forward carefully, he picked his way through the rubble. After 40 or 50 feet, he had reached the edge, allowing him to look out and study the mountainside. It was nothing like the mountain he had left in his own world. The slope here was anything but gentle. From the rough edge of his new cave opening, the stone dropped away vertically for almost 100 feet. Looking down, he could see a winding trail following the slope of the mountainside. Small trees and shrubs grew here and there, but even the ground near the trail looked perilously steep. His eyes followed the trail to the left, until they met those of a young woman looking up at him, her expression filled with surprise. She had a strange hat of some sort perched on her head, with black hair spilling out in a tight braid down her neck, and her shirt was bizarrely patterned with brown, red, and green stripes in a rectangular pattern. Her mouth opened as she called to him, but the words were unfamiliar, and Matthew's attention was taken by a loud crack that shook the stone beneath his feet. For a moment, he feared the rock face beneath him was collapsing, but it held steady. Glancing to his left, he saw a massive shift as the granite wall moved. A portion of its surface, several feet thick, began to slide downward, filling the air with a grating noise that drowned out all other sounds. The rock slide was heading directly for the trail, where the stranger stood. Trying to divert the stone or shield the woman was likely to kill him, as tired as he already was. So instead, he reached out with his power to snatch her out of harm's way. Even at that distance, it would have been a trivial feat, but in his current environment it was a strain. He wrapped the stranger in a soft band of aether, and once his hold was secure, he lifted and pulled her toward him. Matthew was a careful person by nature, and he had had years of practice and play with his sister to perfect his control. He knew almost instinctively how dangerous it could be to move a person too quickly, and even in that moment of stress, he moderated the initial force he applied. Unfortunately, he didn't spend enough time making certain of his own position. He had anchored himself out of habit, but while he focused his attention on his target, the extra difficulty of using aether in this new world caused his grip on the stone at his feet to slip. The young wizard felt the ground slide from beneath his feet, and his stomach tried to jump into his throat. He was falling. If he had had time to calmly observe what was happening, he might have pondered the unexpected turn of events with some humour, but instead he only had time for one thought. Shit! Pulling harder on the thread of Aethar that bound them together, he met the woman in mid-air, and as their bodies slammed together, he felt the air leave his lungs. He ignored the pain of that as he surrounded them both with a springy cushion of pure Aethar to break their fall. They bounced when they hit the ground, and the sudden change of direction threatened to pull them apart. Matthew gripped her harder, using both his arms and his power to hold the woman close as they spun in the air. Their second landing was farther down the mountainside and no less violent, sending them back into the air again. With each bounce, they rolled and fell farther down the steep slope. Matthew couldn't breathe, and he felt his strength failing. "This isn't going to end well." Looking into the eyes of the woman, he couldn't read her expression. Fear? Shock? Or was it simple surprise? A heavy copse of trees hove its way into view. Unable to speak, he sent a thought to the stranger. "You're going to be all right. I promise." The shade of the trees blocked out the sun as he used the last of his aether to stop their spin and put himself between her and the onrushing trunks. Then the world went white. Chapter 3 Karen blinked as a bead of sweat dripped into her eye. Stopping for a moment, she removed her hat and used the hem of her shirt to wipe her damp forehead. The mountain air was cool and dry, but she had set a hard pace for herself going up the trail. "Time for a break," she told herself. She had a habit of talking to herself. It was something that might be expected for a hiker, alone on a long trail. But for Karen, it was a part of everyday life. She had grown up with very few people around, and after her father's death, she rarely saw other people in the flesh. She had plenty of friends. She wasn't antisocial, but talking to people online didn't completely fill the need. It was almost as though her vocal cords simply demanded the exercise. Sitting on a relatively smooth outcropping of rock near the trail, she pulled her PM out and looked at it. There were several additional notifications waiting for her attention. With a sigh, she shoved it back into her pocket. She was hiking to get away from such things, though it hardly mattered. She could be just as alone at home as she was 100 miles from other human beings. "But back there, I wouldn't get to see all the flowers or smell the fresh air," she said softly. Glancing skyward, she gauged the position of the sun, purposely ignoring the urge to pull her PM back out just to check the time. "Mid-afternoon. I've got hours to go before I have to worry about light. I'll wait a couple more hours before calling the pert for my gear." Setting up camp in the dark was no fun, so she had learned to give herself plenty of time to accomplish the task. Plus, it would take 20 or 30 minutes for the pert to reach her. She pulled a bottle from her shoulder bag and took a drink of water. Zipping the bag back up, she held it out in front of her for a moment, contemplating its light weight. She carried very little in it, aside from her water, a small bag of trail mix, and extra sunscreen. She couldn't imagine what backwoods hiking had been like in the old days, when people had had to carry everything with them. "They must have been tough. I get tired just carrying this little thing." The wind had died for the moment, so Karen fanned herself using her boonie for a few seconds, before putting it back on her head. "Time to get moving." She stood and began picking her way along the trail again, following it ever higher into the mountains. Karen ascended slowly for another half an hour. She was beginning to pant now. The trees had begun to thin out, and she knew the tree line was probably less than a few 100 feet higher up. Of course, gaining that extra several 100 feet might mean trekking another mile along the trail, as it slowly wound back and forth up the difficult terrain. "I don't really want to camp any higher up," she told herself. "Maybe I'll stop here and in the morning go on. That'll put me well into the descending portion of the trail before it gets dark tomorrow." She pulled out her PM to locate herself on the map. The first thing that grabbed her attention, as always, was the notification alert. 3 messages from Dad and 1 from Mum? What the heck? Since transitioning, her mother rarely bothered to contact her anymore. 1 or 2 messages a year was the most she expected, and that was fine with Karen. She bypassed the message alert. There would be plenty of time to review them later, after the tent was up. She was just starting to look at the map when something flashed farther up the trail. Looking up, she searched the trail ahead, along with the nearly vertical stone face that rose to the right of it. A tremor passed beneath her feet as a thunderous crack sounded, and stone flew from the stone wall in exactly the place she was looking. What the hell? The explosion was clearly not natural. Was someone using explosives? Something like that should be illegal on public land, especially so close to a hiking trail. A cloud of dust hung in the air above until a sudden gust of wind dispersed it. She stared at the opening that was revealed and was utterly surprised when a man stepped into view a moment later. He must have been right there when it blew. How reckless can you be? The man looked down at her, his eyes meeting hers with a look of surprised curiosity. The wind tossed his light brown hair as he gazed at her. He was slender-built, but otherwise perfectly average in his form. What really caught her attention was the strange attire he wore. A sudden pop took her attention off him for a moment, and a glance above and to her right showed her a huge section of the mountainside sloughing off. It was sliding directly toward her. There was no time, none. Even if she had been running already, she couldn't hope to clear the endangered portion of the trail quickly enough. Something touched her, accompanied by another flash of that same strange light. Or was it light? She could see it, sort of, but she felt it as well, and the sensation brought with it a wave of dizziness. Or perhaps that came because she was flying through the air. The ground must have pitched her upward somehow, although she could have sworn she was being pulled. She saw the stranger slip and fall, his face registering surprise. Their eyes locked again, and she saw his arms open wide. He was growing closer, almost as if he was flying purposely toward her like some strange bird. He looked determined rather than afraid. Without thinking about it, she bent at the waist, drawing her legs up to shield her body from the impact as they slammed into one another, and she heard a whoosh as the air went out of his lungs. Her knees had struck him in the belly. Even so, his arms went around her, gripping her fiercely against him. Fire raced along her nerves as their bodies came into contact. He can't be that strong. It felt as though they were bound together by ropes. And then they were falling, and fear finally found her heart. Everything up to that point had happened so rapidly that her mind hadn't had a chance to react properly. She felt it now, though, a rush of adrenaline as her heart began to flutter in her chest, with her breath coming in shallow gasps. They landed, but were somehow unhurt, and then they were flying again, spinning through the cold mountain air. He was staring at her, no, through her, as though he was distracted. Then his eyes focused on her. "He's glowing," she realized. And then she felt him inside her, a voice within the privacy of her heart. It was a feeling, a thought, or perhaps it was a different language. The words were strange, but she could taste the meaning of them. "You're going to be okay." Their bodies turned in the air, and then she saw the trees slam into his back. Karen opened her eyes again, though she didn't remember closing them. It was dark, and she couldn't breathe, as though a great weight was pressing down on her chest. She tried to roll over, and then she understood. The stranger was on top of her. Light was filtering through the trees and creeping around the edges of his hair. The sun was still up. "I'm alive," she managed to whisper, but she needed to get out from under him. Absently, she noticed his smell, distinctly masculine, and yet unusual in some ways she found hard to define. It fit well with his odd choice in clothing, earthy and mild, as though he bathed regularly, but had never discovered deodorant. She grunted as she rolled his limp form to one side and clambered out from under him. She took a moment to study the stranger. He was obviously wealthy. Everything he wore was bespoke. In fact, as she looked closer, she could see that even the stitching had been hand-done. Unlike most handmade clothes, however, these were masterfully fashioned. What truly made them odd was the style. Was he some sort of medieval enthusiast? He wore at least two layers, a richly embroidered grey tunic with wide sleeves that came halfway down his arms, covered a not-quite-white under-tunic with sleeves that tapered to fit him all the way to his wrists. At his waist was a sturdy leather belt, chased with silver metal. Both the buckle and the tip appeared to be silver, with small emerald stones ornamenting them. The pouch and scabbards it held were similarly adorned.
"Who carries a sword into the wilderness?"
she asked him, though she didn't expect an answer. He was completely unconscious.
"Is he breathing? How could she have been so stupid?
After hitting the trees, there was every chance he might be dead or dying.
She should have checked that immediately."
Leaning forward, she placed her ear gently against his chest. The material there was smooth and soft, though perhaps stiffer than cotton. She could hear his heart beating steadily within his chest. As she raised her head, she saw a glint of gold at his throat, a bit of metal peeking out from his collar. With one hand, she pulled a heavy chain out of his shirt where she could examine it.
"Costume jewelry?"
she wondered aloud. While his clothes were obviously expensive beyond belief, there was no way the necklace could be gold. It was made of links that were thick enough to have been part of the chain on a child's swing set, although they were much more elegantly formed. The links were square and designed in such a way that they could lie flat against the skin. If it were real, it would have been worth tens of thousands of dollars, if not more. Even people who could afford such clothes wouldn't be foolish enough to walk around displaying that much precious metal openly. There was no way it was real.
"What a tacky necklace," she observed. "You aren't a rapper, are you, my mysterious friend?"
Karen laughed at the thought. There weren't any rappers anymore.
"At least not in this world."
A small trickle of blood made its way from one nostril and down the man's cheek. Karen felt a sudden surge of panic. Was he dying? Perhaps he had hit his head. He might be hemorrhaging internally. She had heard of people walking away from similar accidents, complaining of nothing more than a headache, only to die hours later.
"I've got to get us off this mountain."
She reached into her pocket to retrieve her PM. The pert could have them back to civilization in less than an hour. It wasn't there.
"No, no, no, no! God damn it!"
she swore.
When had she seen it last?
Right before the rock slide. She must have dropped it. Glancing back up the steep rocky slope, she knew it was probably buried under several tons of rock. What would she do now? She couldn't summon her pert, and it had taken her 4 days to hike this far into the mountains. There was no way she could carry someone back out the same way.
And what about food, water, shelter? Sweet Jesus!
It would start getting cold in a few hours, and all of her gear, her tent, sleeping bag, everything, was all packed up in the pert storage compartment. She closed her eyes and held herself still.
"First things first, Karen. What's your first priority?" "He's breathing, but unconscious. I can't do anything about a head injury, but I should check him over to make sure there aren't any other serious injuries."
She stared at the man once again.
"Do I have to take his clothes off?"
Karen shook her head.
"I probably should, but I don't know that I could get them back on him, and it will be getting cold. I'll check for broken bones, but unless I see blood, the clothes stay on."
That was something of a relief. She hadn't really wanted to strip him. Running her hands along his torso, she felt his ribs and then along his arms, but found nothing out of place. A visual inspection revealed no blood, other than what was trickling from his nose. She continued her search, moving down over his hips and checking the long bones of his legs. The first was fine, but the right leg had a suspicious bend in the thigh. Probing it with her fingers caused her patient to groan.
"Groaning is a good sign, maybe."
She had no idea, but she hoped it meant his unconsciousness wasn't a result of serious brain injury.
"I should have studied medicine instead of pharmacy. Not that either is worth a damn anymore."
Of course, her current situation belied that statement. Obviously, there were extraordinary circumstances where it was handy for a person to know something of the old disciplines.
"So, you've got a broken femur," she told the stranger. "That probably won't kill you, unless you've also torn an artery, but I have no way to know, and even if I did, I wouldn't begin to know how to treat it. So I'm just going to assume it's fine. In addition, you have a head injury, also something I can't do much about."
She was forgetting something.
"Oh!"
Leaning forward, she pried one of his eyelids open, letting the sunlight spill in. He had blue eyes, and the iris contracted as the light shone in.
"That's good, I think."
Having done as much as she could to assess her patient, she considered her next priority. We need to get farther down, where it won't be as cold tonight. How in the hell was she supposed to move a grown man by herself? Even if he weren't unconscious, he certainly couldn't walk with his leg in that condition. A litter, she pronounced. Is that the right term? She wasn't sure, but it didn't really matter. The only tool she was carrying was her pocket knife. She didn't relish the idea of trying to cut even slender saplings with that. Fortunately, a much larger blade was right at hand. It might not be an axe, but she figured the sword would be easier than a Swiss Army knife. Gripping the hilt, she slid the weapon from its scabbard and then whistled. It wasn't a toy. The blade was almost 3 feet in length and was polished to a brilliant sheen. Double-edged, it looked to be very sharp, though she didn't try her fingers on the edge. Making a slow circuit of the area, she found several small trees with trunks less than 2 inches in diameter. Karen raised the sword and chopped at one, holding the hilt in both hands. She had expected it to require several swings, if not more, to cut through the base of the tree, but to her surprise the blade bit deeply, almost severing it in one go. She had used an axe before, which should have been a better tool for the task, but it hadn't been that easy. Her second swing finished the job, and when she took aim at another tree, she managed it with a single blow. The sword was impossibly sharp. "Damn thing almost cuts like a lightsaber," she muttered, examining the edge again. There was no sign of damage from the hard use, but she could see a faint shimmer hovering around the edge. "Now I'm imagining things," she thought. With a laugh, she held it out in front of her. "Magic, no doubt about it. This must be the fabled blade, Excalibur." She turned back toward the unconscious stranger. "Which means you must be Arthur." Putting aside her nervous attempt at humor, she cut a third sapling and then used the sword to trim away all the smaller branches before arranging the 3 lengths of wood in a triangle. She returned the sword to its scabbard and borrowed the stranger's knife. It seemed to be just as sharp. She needed rope, but she had that covered. Karen unbuckled her belt, and with a twist removed the buckle and began unravelling the paracord it was constructed from. It had been made for just such a purpose, though she had never seriously believed she would need it. "Sadly, the only knot I can remember is a square knot," she mumbled to herself, as she began attempting to lash the wooden frame together. In the end, she succeeded, but it was not a job any scout would have been proud of, and she had probably used far more of the paracord than was necessary. She added the smaller branches she had cut from the trees earlier, lashing them across the framework, and eventually she had something that she thought might support a body. Karen eyed her handiwork critically. "Not my best work." Getting the man onto the litter turned out to be the worst part of the job. He wasn't particularly heavy for his height, but even 160-some-odd pounds of dead weight was a serious challenge. Thankfully, she wasn't small. At 5 feet and 10 inches, Karen was taller than most women she knew. She was also in excellent shape. She got her arms under his shoulders and hooked her elbows beneath his armpits. Grunting and swearing, she tugged and pulled until she had him roughly positioned on the ramshackle litter. The sun was beginning to drop behind the mountains to the west, and she knew she didn't have much time left. An hour and a half later, she was convinced she had made a mistake. Karen hurt everywhere. Her hands were raw and sore. She had lost some skin while making the litter, and even more dragging the damn thing down the rough-and-tumble mountainside. Then there were her muscles. Her back hurt, her shoulders hurt, and her legs had been tired before she had even started all of this. Worse still, she wasn't covering much distance. The litter might have been a big help across even terrain, but going downhill it was a constant struggle. The wide end kept catching between bushes, rocks, and small trees, forcing her to stop and free it before she could continue. How far had she gone? "I doubt I've gotten us much more than 300 or 400 feet down this damned mountain." "This sucks," she swore. "How much worse can it get?" As if in answer to her question, a light rain began to fall. Karen cast her eyes skyward. "Forget I asked." She kept going for another hour, until the light became so poor that she began to worry about injuring herself in the dark. In the distance, she could hear the sound of rushing water, which was a good sign, since it meant she must be getting close to the bottom. The rain had stopped, and there wasn't much wind, but her clothes were still damp, and even a slight breeze of the now chilly air made her shiver. Her passenger didn't seem to notice, but his skin was cold and clammy to the touch.
"This is going to be a fun night."
She propped the head of her litter on a short stone that stood only a foot from the ground. That kept it off the wet soil. Casting her eyes about, she looked for something she could use to help insulate them, but none of the thin bushes that grew nearby looked appealing. There were some dead leaves on the ground, but they were wet, and she didn't care for the thought of whatever insects might be hiding in them. Snakes didn't bother her. Most bugs were okay, too. But the thought of possibly finding a centipede made her skin crawl.
"Why don't you have one of those giant wool cloaks they always wear in fantasy novels?" she asked, addressing the unconscious man again.
As usual, he didn't reply. She tried propping herself up against a tree, but she was soon shivering, and sleep was out of the question. Her patient didn't shiver, but looking down at him made her feel worse.
"If I'm cold, he might die of hypothermia. His body isn't even responding."
Standing, she moved over and lay down on the litter beside him. Getting comfortable was difficult. The cross pieces were just wide enough to cause them to cut into her back, and sharp twigs seemed to be everywhere. But she made the best of it. Pressing herself close against the stranger's left side to avoid the injured leg, she closed her eyes. A thought occurred to her then.
What if he wakes up?
That was stupid. He was in no condition to be a threat, and even if he tried anything, it would only take one poke to his leg to end any such thoughts. Karen sighed as she closed her eyes.
I'm never going to be able to sleep like this.
But her tired body had other ideas, and she was soon fast asleep. Chapter 4 Matthew scratched at his cheek. There was something dry and crusty stuck there. Opening his eyes, he found himself confronted by a dazzling display of stars. The sky was black and absolutely clear, revealing a celestial show of unparalleled beauty. His body was mostly cold, but one side was warmer than the other. Nestled against him was the woman he had seen earlier, or at least he assumed it was her. It was hard to tell in the dark, and his mage sight was almost absent in this dead world. He kept still for a few minutes, creating a dim light to see by, and then examining his surroundings. He was off the ground, suspended on a rough litter, and he didn't think he was in the same place where he had lost consciousness, though he couldn't be sure. He also needed to pee. The pain struck when he tried to get up, and an involuntary groan passed his lips.
"Fuck, that hurts,"
he thought. Turning his mage sight inward was easier. There was plenty of Aethar within him to see by.
"My leg is broken."
He supposed that was to be expected. It could have been much worse. Drawing upon what strength he had, he attempted to straighten the bone before fusing it back together, and nearly screamed.
"Idiot! Of course it hurts! You know better! Block the nerves first!"
he chided himself. He was glad his sister wasn't there to see his mistake. She was always loftily superior about her healing skills. Starting again, he blocked the nerves this time, and succeeded in getting the bones back in place and mended. The bruising he couldn't do much about, but there didn't seem to be much damage otherwise. Releasing the nerve block, he gently eased himself up from the litter, hissing at the soreness when he put weight on the injured leg. It held him up, though. Limping slowly, he went a short distance before unlacing his trousers and relieving himself. With that important business taken care of, he returned and spent a few minutes considering the girl. She looked thoroughly miserable, wet and shivering on the litter. Once again, he reached futilely into his empty belt pouch. With a sigh, he withdrew his hand. He felt weak as a kitten, but he could probably do something about their damp clothes and the cold air. Muttering softly, he used his aether to expel the moisture from the woman's clothes first, then he took care of his own. A wave of dizziness came over him, accompanied by a throbbing pain in his head.
"I definitely overdid it earlier."
He wasn't suffering from feedback sickness, though. The headache would have been much worse. He had simply pushed himself too far. Lying back down on the litter, he eased himself closer to the woman before creating an envelope of warm air around the two of them. Her shivering stopped after several minutes, and she seemed to sigh contentedly, but she didn't awaken. Matthew ached all over. It felt as though even his bruises had bruises, and the hard, irregular surface of the litter didn't help. He took a while adjusting his position until the wooden lattice was positioned so that it was pressing into relatively uninjured places, and then he closed his eyes. He didn't think he would sleep, but when he opened them again, the bright morning sun was already shining on his face. The woman was leaning over him, staring down with concern on her features. He smiled. "I'm all right." She frowned. Matthew started to get up. The wooden frame was cutting into him in various places, making his aches and pains even worse. The woman put her hand on his chest, pushing him back down. She said something, but he couldn't understand her words. It sounded like a warning or cautionary statement from her tone. "What did you say?" he asked. Her reply was equally unintelligible, though he thought he caught the word "no" in it. "Great," he thought. "We don't speak the same language." It was something he should have expected. He tried again. "Nice to meet you. My name is Matthew." She responded with a long utterance that was irritatingly familiar, but still unintelligible. It sounded as if she was speaking Barian, but the words didn't make sense. He felt as though he should understand what she was saying, but he couldn't find any meaning in her sentences other than the occasional word that he recognized. In this case, the only word he was certain of was "no." Patting his chest again, he kept his reply short. "Matthew." After a second, she did the same. "Karen." Then she pointed at him. "Matthew." "Yes," he nodded. Her eyes lit up. "Yes." She followed that with another strange sentence that seemed to emphasize the word "yes." "So we have yes and no in common," he decided. "Her language must be either a precursor to Barian, or it could have developed from it. That should make it easier to learn to understand one another." He sat up and started to get off the litter again. "No," she declared, following the word with an obvious warning as she pointed at his leg. Matthew smiled. "My leg is fine. I'm a wizard." Karen shook her head. "No, Matthew." Using hand gestures and more peculiar phrases, she made it clear that he should remain still. He pointed at his leg again. "I fixed it." When that didn't seem to elicit any comprehension, he put his hand on his chest again. "Wizard." She repeated the word "wizard" and then laughed. Clearly the word held some meaning for her, although he wasn't sure if she laughed because she thought it was silly, or if it meant something entirely different. "As far as I know, I just told her I was a jackass or something." He sighed, and tried to consider a different approach, but it was at that moment when he heard the rustling of bushes nearby. It wasn't the casual sound of the wind catching branches, it was much louder. Something large, probably an animal, was approaching. People often mistakenly assumed that animals were silent in the forest, but nothing could be further from the truth. In actuality, they just had better hearing and usually moved away when they detected humans nearby. This animal was large, however, and it wasn't moving away. Once again, Matthew felt frustration at the limits on his mage sight. Back home, he would have detected anything that large long before it came within range of hearing, while here, his mage sight extended only a few tens of feet from his location. Without any ambient native aethar, he could only sense things that were within the reach of the aethar that must be radiating from his own body. Sort of like a man carrying a lantern on a dark night, he supposed. Holding one finger in front of his lips, he hoped that Karen would understand that he wanted her to be quiet. Then he pointed toward the bushes, as he sent a faint pulse of aethar in that direction. It illuminated the world for him, and his mage sight was temporarily able to register the large bear that was slowly working its way toward them. Matthew was no woodsman, but he had learned enough woodcraft to know that bears didn't approach humans without a purpose. Ordinarily, they found an excuse to leave an area if they sensed humans nearby. He and Karen had been talking loudly enough that it must know they were there. That meant it was approaching them deliberately. It was probably hungry, and trying to decide whether they would make an easy meal. Karen stopped, pursing her lips when she saw Matthew holding one finger in front of his mouth. She had been frustrated to discover that they couldn't communicate properly. If she'd still had her PM, it wouldn't have been a problem. It could have detected whatever language he was using and been able to translate for them. Or, if I were normal,